Welcome to The Last Geek in Space. This issue, the creator of War Machine, Kev Hopgood. Welcome to The Last Geek in Space, the podcast where we send comic book creators into the great beyond, with nothing but magazines, artwork and music for company. My name's Alan Kelsall, and today's Geekonaut is Kev Hopgood. Kev's one of the UK's leading comic book artists, and during his time on Iron Man helped create War Machine and Hulkbuster. As well as chatting about his career, Kev will be selecting some of his favourite artwork, comics and music to take with him, as he dons his silver spacesuit to boldly go where no geek has gone before. So hi Kev.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm fine. We're going to ask you a few questions. We're going to start off. You're going to be allowed the first comic you ever bought. We're going to go back in time.
The first comic I ever bought?
The first you remember owning or
Where
about.
To start? The first comic I remember collecting, I didn't actually buy it, my parents bought it for me, was the Beano. I had a huge stack of them in the corner of the room. I shared with my brother. And from there, I graduated to the Sparky, I don't know if you remember the Sparky, and then the Wizard. Which is more...
Wizard.
Yeah, which is more war comics and adventure, what have you.
I never liked Wizard. Warlord, I was more into Bullet.
No, Wizard was one for me. God knows why, but anyway. However, my life really changed, for better or worse, when I discovered the black and white reprints of Marvel comics in the pages of magazines such as Fantastic, Power and Smash. And later on, The Mighty World of Marvel, you probably remember.
I was chatting to David Leitch about that the other week, and the first issue came out in 72 when I was 6 years old.
God.
I spent at least 2 years running around in my green-skinned Monster Transfer t-shirt.
Well, I had a really cool Steve, and I found out later it was drawn by Steve Ditko, like an 83 transfer, which I got free with some of the comics. My mum put it into an older PE bag.
Oh, wow.
So that was the coolest thing I ever had for years, I think, you know.
Those PAL comics are brilliant as well.
Yeah.
They were the first, the Fantastic Annual 1970 was the first time I saw Marvel comics.
Okay. Yeah, it just seemed like a gateway to another world, you know.
Yeah. And they actually rewrote a few of them.
So oh, did they? For the British? Oh, okay.
So they sort of took out some of the Americanisms.
Because from there, I got onto tracking down American comics. I always wanted a zip code. I wanted to buy that submarine. I wanted to have those X-ray specs, you know. I wanted the sea monkeys.
I want to see what had happened. Sea monkeys were rubbish. We got some.
Were they? I expected they would be.
Remember at Panini and Tunbridge Wells, we finally got around to buying some. And they don't read the newspaper. They don't watch TV. They're just little grubs that swim around a ball and then die.
Yeah. It's like waiting for Godot, really, isn't it?
Fake advertising, even then. It's shocking, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, so that was my gateway drug. It would blow all my pocket money on whatever full-colour US imports I could get my hands on.
Wow.
One I still remember was a Jim Starling copy of Warlock. Do you remember that?
Yeah. It was great.
I'd been forbidden from buying comics by my parents because I was blowing all my money on them, despite money I'd earned from my paper round. But they said I was wasting it. Looking back, it was a pretty shameless rip-off of ideas found in Michael Moorcock novels. But I thought they were incredibly cool.
And
And, you know, I just love Jim Starlin's style, you know.
Yeah, that was great. That first Adam Warlock series.
Yeah.
I loved
it. It was like Forbidden Fruit. That was my first act of pre-teenage rebellion.
My folks never banned any comic for me. The only thing they banned when I was a teenager was they found a copy of The Irish Witch by Dennis Wheatley. With one of those, you know, semi-naked women on the cover from the 70s. And
well, could be,
no
one could believes be a Mandingo or something.
No one believes this. My mum opened it up straight into a sex scene. And it was purely by accident, you know, even though I was 13. And it took me 4 years to find another second-hand copy. I was 50 pages away
and
from
God
the
knows
end.
You tried.
I tried everywhere. I was 50 pages away from the ending, and it was a rubbish ending as well.
Oh,
it
no.
wasn't worth the wait. So what else? Where did you used to buy your Marvel comics from? Your
it was newsagents.
Yeah.
You know, just crap. Yeah, and you could never guarantee getting a run of the comics.
Yeah, that's it.
Although, when I was a bit older, I started going down to London with a few friends or on my own. Discovered a comic shop called Dark Lure and Golden Eyes.
I used to dream about it. I couldn't make it to
up north. It was great. You know, people just hang out there all day. And I certainly did. You know,
yeah.
So that's where I filled in my comics education, such as it was.
My dad took me to a comic mart when I was 14.
Oh.
And he still says that he's never seen me as happy. So from that time then, or even later on, so you know, with your Beanos and Marbles, if you only let you take one of those old original comics with you, what do you think it'd be?
I think probably be one of... pre-Marvel, you mean? Or?
Yeah, from the first thing that made an impact on me.
Yeah, right. What character did I used to like? I didn't know at the time, but I used to be an artist called Ian Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
And they didn't used to sign their names.
That's right.
But anything drawn by him, I thought, like, this is so cool. Garth comics with Daily Mirror.
You know,
Frank Bellamy is a huge fan. So I attracted more to artists than characters, I think.
Yeah.
If it was artists I liked, I'm there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Switch up a bit then. If you're going to have one comic of all time.
Right. Well, I was thinking about this. There are a lot of comics. It's all that is wham bam, fly through a building, so what? Whereas the first comic that with actually had an emotional impact on me, without a doubt, it's Spider-Man issue 90. It's the death of Captain Stacy. Yeah. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's a panel at the end when you realise that he's known that Peter Parker is really Spider-Man all along. And it's some of Stanley's best writing. It really, well up now thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's pure soap opera and shamelessly tugs at the heartstrings, but I loved it. You know, it's brilliant.
That's Liam Gil Kane.
It was Gil Kane drawing that one, yeah.
So I had an interview with John Romita Sr. years later. He said it always kind of bugged him that he got to miss all the big issues. The Gwen Stacy, the Greta Captain Stacy.
They used to get bringing Gil for those ones, didn't they? Yeah. It must have bugged him.
Yeah, it was the death of Gwen Stacy for me.
Oh, yes. Yeah. How many issues later was it?
I was only 20 issues, 23 issues later.
Bad luck, that family.
That's terrible. So, it's that spider luck. So from then on, going back to how you started in comics, you're always a fan. I remember seeing your work when I was young in fanzines.
I started off in the fanzines.
So how did you get your first break?
I'm trying to think, actually.
Was it Harrier? Because I remember seeing
it. I had work in Harrier Comics. Yeah. James Hill wrote a thing called Forest.
Yeah.
You know James. And I think I drew the first issue, then drawing the second issue. Then I realised that I wasn't getting paid for this. I couldn't afford to do it. This is a shame for James. But, that got me noticed by some of the guys at Marvel UK. And what didn't hurt is that I'd also met Richard Starkings at comic conventions previously, and I've met him through the fanzines, what have you. And he just got a job at Marvel on the staff, so he was all like our little mole, basically. So he got my stuff under John Tomlinson's nose, and who else worked there? Simon Furman and.
Was Steve White there?
See, Steve White came, I think he started about the same time I did.
I know Gary Gilbert would have been there.
Gary Gilbert,
He got Stevie's job, I think. Yeah.
Who writes Zoids? I can't remember his name now. He's bugging me.
Is it Ian Rimmer?
Ian Rimmer, that's the one. Well, Richard sort of told him about me, but he was the one who actually got me the gig, was drawing Zoids and Spider-Man Zoids.
Ah, someone put that on Facebook recently, I think.
I saw it and shared it.
That was like Transformers.
Giant dinosaur robots, and I can't understand why they weren't bigger than Transformers.
They were, because they were dinosaurs.
They're bigger than trucks, aren't they? Yeah. I never got the why would the robot turn into a truck? It just didn't.
I know, that never made sense.
I much prefer drawing the Zoids. I thought this is great. There's dinosaurs and robots. What else do you need?
Yeah, that sounds great. And then what else did you do for Marvel UK?
From there, I think it was about a year. Did I spend a year doing that? Quite a while, anyway. And then I got offered Action Force. So I drew quite a few Action Force issues. And then I did some Thundercats, I think, and some Ghostbusters. Did a couple of Doctor Who stories. That's pretty much my career at Marvel UK, I think.
Action Force is interesting. Because it had... Doug Braithwaite started in there.
Doug Braithwaite started.
Grant Morrison, I think, wrote some issues as well.
Yeah, he wrote some of the final issues of the Zoids strip at one time, which is quite cool.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know what happened to him.
Yeah, I know. God knows.
And you went from there to straight to Marvel America, was it?
No. In fact, John Tomlinson and Steve Cook, working at UK, they also knew a lot of the guys at 2000 AD, Alan McKenzie and Richard Burton and what have you. And they sort of like put my stuff in front of their noses. And I got the traditional Tharg's Future Shock to draw. Yep. Well, I got two or three of those. And then I got offered a strip called Night Zero, which is written by John Brosnan.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we've got three series of that, which is quite cool.
Yeah.
I did a few Judge Dredds and then did some Harlem Heroes. And then from there, I got offered to work at Marvel in the States. Yeah.
Never looked back after that.
Touchwood, I'm still working.
Yeah. So, you've got a love of comics, like we all have, but we're going to let you have one graphic novel.
One graphic novel. Well, it's got toss ups, really. I'm going to. It's either Killing Joke, Batman. Or The Watchmen, which is both written by Alan Moore, and I think he's sort of like, he just nailed. In fact, it's almost like you can not do any more superhero comics because I think they've been done now. When I finished watching Watchmen, I thought, well, that's it, I'm done with this now.
Every writer since seems to be riffing off either those two or Marvel Man.
They redid The Watchmen recently, and it's very, very nicely drawn. But I thought, why is this thing even existing?
Like,
you know,
it's like doing a follow up. They did a follow up to Casablanca, but it's fan fiction.
Yeah.
It's not real.
So those two, I have to take one of those.
Yeah.
It's not a desert island, it's a spaceship.
Nothing like a desert island.
Yeah.
And looking, you became an artist for Marvel. I know you had a big hit with War Machine and Iron Man. I think you've drawn Iron Man for about 3 or 4 years.
It's quite a long run. Well, it's not a long run in today's terms. Yeah. Tend to not get such long runs these days.
And you're working with Len Kaminski, I think.
That's right,
And that's when you... Can you want to talk a bit, actually, before we get on to your choice of artwork, how War Machine came about?
Well, it's... I'd met Neil Yomtov, the editor, at a comic convention, one of the UCACs they used to have. And he was out here, back over here looking for artists. And I showed him my stuff, and he liked it. And I got a tryout gig. Or in fact, I got two tryout gigs. There was did an episode of Deathlok, which was really cool because I it's a character I really like. And then I did Darkhawk, which wasn't so connected with the character, but it was quite a good exercise.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a cool design.
Yeah.
Then I got the first issue, and it was one off at the time, issue of Iron Man. I thought, well, I did know they were looking for a new artist, so I can't screw this one up. And I think Leonard liked the job I'd done on Deathlok, so he'd kind of put a good word in for me as well. So did a one-off issue of Iron Man, and then luckily I got the gig, and I thought, right, this is it now. This is what I've been aiming for all my life. And the first issue we got to draw featured, basically the character description was, it's Iron Man, but cooler. So we spent a good week or so knocking ideas back and forwards. And this is before, pardon me, before the internet. So it's doing everything by fax. God knows how we did anything. And pretty soon we nailed the sort of black and silver color scheme, which is like a punk rock version of Iron Man.
Yeah.
In my mind. And also I wanted to turn Iron Man into a walking tank.
Yeah.
And his 90s, so he strapped some guns on, it was never a miss. And that's how War Machine came about. We only thought it'd be around for like 3 issues, and that's it, bye-bye, But it hit a nerve somehow, and it stayed around.
Yeah, it's still going. I think we've done 2 issues now in the Marvel Movie Collection.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
And you've been out to Hollywood, I think.
Me and my wife got invited to the premiere of Avengers 2, which is really cool. Before that, we'd been invited, we went to Iron Man 1. But that was in the UK.
Yeah.
It's the Westfield in West London.
Shepherd's Bush.
Yeah. It's really, strange place of a premiere. Mm. And all the cars were going to be over. Is it when the Icelandic ash cloud was on?
Oh.
So they didn't come over. They sent a video message. I thought, this is pants. So the following year, was it a year later? Anyway, Avengers 2, we got flown out to LA, which is nice. We've never been to LA before, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
And then, we're on the red carpet. Halfway up there are these mannequins of all Danny Jr. and the rest of the cast. And they're life size. They're really impressive looking. So everyone's there taking selfies. Then suddenly this woman comes on and says, move away, move away. There's some talent coming through. I thought,
You created it. You're the talent.
Well, it's some Beatrice from Game of Thrones. Yeah. I didn't know who she was. But so, I felt like saying, we're the comics, we're the talent here. Yeah. It's not for us comics guys. No one's here, you know. But yeah. I didn't. No. Well, just bumbled along like Hugh Grant, you know.
Comic creators never get the respect.
Well, what was nice about that one actually is the first movie that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby had got co-credit. And me and my wife, we sat next to Lennon, a friend of his, and behind us were the Kirby girls, Gap Joe, his widow, and his two daughters.
That'd be a cool name for a comic, wouldn't it?
Kirby girls, yeah. Yeah. But then, you know, the Jack Kirby's credit came out, the huge, you know, round of applause happened in the audience. That was kind of a cool moment, you know.
Obviously, Kirby influenced you, but what were the comic artists?
There's a group of four which is I really follow. Whereas Jack Kirby, obviously. Although at the time I didn't know I was being influenced by him, but all the early ones were drawn by him. And yeah. I just thought, this is cool. I didn't even look at the names, you know. Then there's, I discovered Gene Colan is a big influence. Yeah. I just love his shadows.
So fluid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, him and Tom Palmer, a magic combination for me.
Two Dracula still.
And such a long run as well. And the quality didn't let up as well. So that's one of my all-time favourites. And there's Gil Kane, I really like, and John Buscema.
Oh, yeah, John Buscema's the man.
Yeah, so those four is it for me.
Now, we're going to let you take one page of original artwork. You can take a page of your own and a page by any comic book creator from any comic that's ever existed.
Right, okay. So,
which two pages you take? First, let's start with one of your own pages.
Okay, well, it's going to be War Machine, because it's what I'm known for. It's the final page of Iron Man 281. It's a full-page spread with some really nice inks by Bob Wycheck. And it's the first time we see War Machine.
I've used that a lot over the years.
I've been starting to get asked to do cover recreations, and I've redrawn it a few times, to be honest. So that's of my work. That's my favourite.
Any idea who has that page these days?
It was before we knew it might become worth something. Yeah. I sold it to a friend for probably 30 quid.
Oh, wow.
And they gave it to their husband, and he had hung it in the toilet for a while. And then his nephew or niece or son.
Don't say they drew on it.
No, he's got given to somebody else. I don't know who it is.
Oh, wow.
So I would quite like to get that back to me.
I can imagine.
But, you know, I've sold it, so it's gone.
I'd give you 35 quid for it.
I could go up to this kid and offer him 35, couldn't I? Yeah, so
comic art has shot up in value over the last few years as well.
Exactly, yeah.
It's amazing. And so if you could have one page by expensive comic art, not that yours isn't, but one page by any of the all-time greats.
It would have to be a Gene Colan and Tom Palmer. I couldn't nail one Tomb of Dracula page, but any one of those I'd just love to have. In fact, I may Google it now and see what they're worth.
Buy out the next set of royalties from the next
year. We still do get a few royalties. So.
I went to one of the London conventions last year in the... there's a company selling original artwork.
Oh, right.
And I was looking through some of them with a mate, and the prices these days were just eye-watering.
There are some collectors out there who don't mind spending on
things. Yeah. I mean, 10 years ago, you could buy pages for, a few hundred quid. Yeah, now it's just crazy.
Yeah.
So, covers as well, though. We're going to let you, again, we'll do the same thing. You can take one of your own covers and a cover by another artist.
Okay. Right, well, my own cover, again, it's War Machine. Yeah. It's Iron Man 282. And it's just a sort of a looking up shot of War Machine.
We'll pop it on the Facebook page.
Oh, okay, so when I saw the way it all came together with the Stark design, I got the first inkling that this character might have sort of legs beyond the first few issues were originally planned for him. That would have to be of my own work. And another cover. Again, it's got to be Gene Colan again, probably from Tomb of Dracula as well. Although I loved his work on Iron Man, actually.
Was it Nathaniel Dark he did?
Oh, yes. In fact, there's one, there's a vampire who's a private investigator.
Oh, yeah.
What was that called? Hannibal something, was it?
Yeah. forgot his name.
Yeah, it was a cool character. Again, that's a really good storytelling. You only find out.
See, this is what happens when you record something in a place with no Wi-Fi. You have to use our memories instead of the internet.
Oh, God. Well, my memory's shot, you know.
That was a great character, though.
Yeah. I know the first thing, the way you got introduced, that you find out he's a vampire, the very last panel.
I still love the first Blade in Tomb of Dracula.
Blade was cool, they were good movies as well, actually. Before the Marvel movies.
They started the Marvel movies. I always think if Marvel weren't going bankrupt around that time, it was just when they were coming out of the bankruptcy, they wouldn't have allowed Matt Blade to be made because it was so violent, so brilliant, so adult. It's unlike anything else. And that started the craze for superhero movies.
Yeah. Who was the actor? Wesley Snipes. He was so cool.
He was the man.
Yeah. And I watched him again recently. He's like every movement he makes, he just looks like a comic book frame.
I watched the first one again recently in the epilogue sort of scene where he's in Russia. And you've got this setup where like a woman's about to be victim of a Russian vampire. And the camera just zooms over. And there's Blade at the end of this corridor looks up at camera. That's the end. That's just they're fantastic. I'll have to watch him again. The second one as well with what's the name from Bloss?
Was it?
The Bloss brothers played the bad vampire in it.
I didn't know
was it Luke Goss or
one of them?
The drummer from Bloss.
Good
actor.
Yeah, he's in Hollywood at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah.
I know from watching his
from watching the
that program.
That was great. I never liked Ross, but I kind of.
I kind of was like, yeah, right. You see where they're coming from now.
Yeah. So we're going to give you a geek-related object to say on the ship.
Okay. Whereas an Iron Man fan sent me a rather cool Hulkbuster figure a while back. Which is still probably placed on my desk or right on my drawing board. So it'll have to be that I think, you know.
You'll have to send us a photo of it.
I will do, I'll do that. Yeah, it's been quite nice to be involved over the years of things that fans look at gladly, even as far back as Zoids, you know, people still remember that, you know, so it's kind of cool.
Well, I remember like going way back to Howie, I was chatting to James Hill about Forest and Howie days.
Oh, right.
And we must have been hanging around the London Marts at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to find out when Howie were going
to
be.
Were you there when that convention where all the fanboys followed Alan Moore into the loo?
Yeah, that was one of the UCACs.
Yeah.
But then the UCACs were great. Yeah, the first one I went to, I remember sitting in a hall listening to, I think it was Howard Chaykin, the Hernandez brothers, Morbius.
Yeah, it was quite a cool time. We didn't realise at the time how cool what time it was.
No, that's it. Yeah. My first convention was about 86, just when Marvel Man was coming out and Watchmen was on the horizon and Dark Knight. And I remember a few seasoned British pros complaining about comics weren't as good as they used to be. And now people are looking back at that time.
Well, the past is always.
Exactly. Yeah, it's always better, I think now is actually one of the best times in comics.
I don't watch or buy or read as many comics as I used to. I'll be getting old.
There's just so many good creator-owned stuff out there these days. You know, Image and Boom are doing some brilliant work.
There's cool stuff happening there.
So we're going to give you one song to take with you
It's a Perfect Day by Lou Reed.
Yep.
Which is, whenever I hear it, it's... I prefer the Kirsty MacColl version, I think. Although it's close.
Can I take the Kirsty MacColl version?
I'll take Kirsty over Lou every time, I think.
Yeah, because her version of New England's brilliant.
Yes, indeed, The song we all know now is that Sunday Afternoon Melancholia, which is we realise that your perfect day you've been having is almost over.
Yeah.
And they shit on the telly.
Well, Doctor Who's on a Sunday night.
Oh, don't get me started. Actually, the last episode was quite good, I thought.
Yeah.
It's to be fair.
A bit hit and miss this year.
It is very, very hit or miss. It's a shame, actually, because my daughter's 14 and she grew up on Doctor Who, the first three of the new batch.
Yeah.
And she's just given up on it now. Since Peter Capaldi, actually.
That's a shame,
because
she's almost the target audience.
Yeah. Although, it's kind of like every generation that seems to have their doctor, and then you move on.
I couldn't watch it for 2 years after John Pertwee stopped being the doctor. I was too young to understand.
Yeah, well, I got Tom Baker, but after Tom Baker, that's it, I'm out of here. I was growing up, discovering girls and things, so.
Really? You stayed in comics? How about one book?
I've got to think about that. I spent a lot of time, in my formative years, reading, as well as reading too much comics. I read a lot of fantasy and science fiction. I read sort of a lot of Edgar Rice Burroughs. And then I graduated onto Michael Moorcock, which is I've still got a fond memories of.
Yeah.
You know, although you try to read some of them now, it's almost as hackneyed as Edgar Rice Burroughs, some of it. You know.
He wrote some of them in a weekend. Didn't
I know. Some of them it shows as well.
But there's still, you know, Elwick.
Yeah.
I mispronounce everything. So where does Elwick come from?
Melnibone. Yeah, that's how I say it.
Melnibone, I'd say. Yeah.
Melnibone. Yeah, actually, my favourite Michael Moorcock book is the Byzantium and Jewels books, which is all. It's basically his history of the 20th century and, you know, and the wars, you know.
There's a brilliant book he did. It's a bit obscure, called Letters from Hollywood.
Oh, I don't know.
It's not a novel. It's a collection of his, literally his letters from Hollywood.
Okay.
So I think he was writing to Brian Aldiss, but he was given, they never named a movie, but it's something like Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, okay.
And he was sort of the Hollywood based. He said, come over. Yeah, yeah. You know, do you want to do the follow-up?
Yeah.
Went, yeah, sure. And they paid him a fortune.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant collection of essays, or letters about his time in Hollywood. Because it all falls apart,
hasn't been a good Michael Moorcock movie made, I don't think.
They're making Elwick.
Are they?
It's in production, but be interested to see what they do with it.
Yeah. Well, I was really obsessed with the Hawkmoon books for ages. Yeah. You know, I used to love them. Yeah.
And also Behold the Man.
Yeah, Behold the Man is a favourite. They're a very good one as well. It still stands up, I think.
Yeah. So, one movie, so I know you're making movies these days, I'm going to let you take a movie up, which you've not done before.
Oh, right, all-time favourite movie. There's so many, but there's an obscure one called A Knight's Tale, I really like, which has got Heath Ledger in. And I just think it's a perfect movie for me. It's funny, action, makes you cry, you know. It's all that, yeah.
Great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack, indeed, yes, yeah. On YouTube, you know, that dance sequence with the David Bowie song. Yeah. What is going on here? But it seems to work somehow.
And who is it who plays Chaucer in that? Can you remember?
Plays who?
Chaucer. Isn't Chaucer?
Oh, yes. Yes. He's very good. I can't remember his name.
Yeah. Oh, God, I forgot. So,
that's bugging. Yeah.
Because with poor Terry Jones dying recently.
Yes, yeah.
When I was in sixth form doing English, Terry Jones had just written a book called The Knight's Tale, based on Chaucer's Knight.
Okay.
And it was great historical work.
Yeah.
But Terry Jones was one of the few people to look at the battle Chaucer mentioned in Canterbury Tales that knight was saying, showing off.
Yeah.
And for years, people believed the knight was this glowing standard of brilliance, you know, in a show, one of the few good characters in Terry Jones looked at all these battles and they were massacres.
And
they were notorious events at
Kill
the time.
Kill the prisoners.
That's it. So it was comedy, but Terry Jones was the only one who bothered to do the research and made them realise that, you know, this guy, everyone would have looked at them and go, he's an arse.
Sir arse.
So you've got into movies though. I know that you're making your own short films.
Yeah, I've been writing sort of seriously about the past 3 or 4 years, I guess. And I've been working from other people's scripts all my working life, and I had a few clunkers. I wanted to see if I could write myself.
Yeah, there's some Spider-Man comic I did for you.
That sucked so much. So I wanted to see if I could write myself, and I started off, embarrassing. I think it's slowly getting better. And I've been finding that comedy comes fairly naturally to me, and also I've been told that dialogue is good as well. I remember things the London comedy writers, and they put on shows fairly regularly. And some of my short comedy sketches, about 10 minutes, I guess, were performed on stage. And they were really well received. So I thought, well, actually, I want a record of this, so I'm going to film this.
Yeah.
So I've made about 4 short comedy films now. And we're editing and doing pro-production on the fifth film now, which is not a comedy at all. So it's a horror story.
It's vampire
horror. Vampire story.
Is that a spoiler?
I think the cat's out of the bag. Yeah, okay. It's out there now. Yeah, it's called The Last Confession. So we'll be coming to your screen soon.
We'll pop it on a link on the Facebook page.
Cool, that'd be cool. Yeah.
So I'll put story time up if you can.
Oh, that'd be cool.
That
was
great. That was really good fun.
Yeah, thank you.
So you're travelling through space in the great unknown, and we're going to stick you with one comic book character.
Okay.
Which one? We're going to give you one you'd like to be on the spaceship with, and one you'd really hate to be on the spaceship
with. Okay. Well, a big fan of early Marvel comics, Jack Kirby. I was from Reed Richards from the Fantastic Four. And he's got to be a contender, I would have thought. His knowledge of rocket science and the danger of cosmic radiation will be helping get into, out of any deep space scrapes.
That's good. That'd be handy. Don't die in space.
Well, you need someone who knows what they're doing, I think. You know. But it's all on a personal level, he's stuck in a tin can with this guy. And he's an insufferable know-it-all. You know, he knows everything.
Yeah.
You know. So his place on the mission would be a bit of a double-edged sword, I think. Yeah.
That's interesting. Other mate didn't want to be stuck with Tony Stark for the same reasons.
Well, yeah.
But would it just be him you wouldn't want to be stuck on with? Or would it be any character you'd really hate to... You'd have to kill if you were stuck on the ship.
God, I can't think. Who would I really hate to be stuck on a spaceship with? I'd be somebody who smells or something. Somebody with bad hygiene. Swamp Thing. Yeah, that'd suck. Okay. Or Man Thing is even worse.
And you'd be scared because you'd be in space. You'd burn at the Man Thing's touch.
Exactly.
As much as I love that catchphrase, it never quite made sense to me. Because if you're walking along and you see this massive bloody swamp monster, you're going to be terrified.
Yes.
So you're going to know fear, and then you're going to burn.
Yeah.
Life
sucks. Get a helmet.
Yeah, exactly. What you up to these days?
All right. Well, I'm doing a lot of educational publishing. This is bringing that to work. Although, having said that, I've just been offered a big chunk of comic book work featuring some military characters, which I'm just doing the concept sketches for now, which are quite cool. I'm also having a crack at writing my first novel. I've been writing five or six screenplays, a couple of stage plays. And I started the same way. I break everything down.
Yeah.
And this time around, I thought, well, instead of writing a screenplay, I'll write it as a novel first.
Yeah.
And then sort of maybe self-publish it and then try and get it noticed that way, you know, as a way of getting my writing noticed.
Well, it fascinates me the way people write novels, because I tend to do it a bit. Stephen King said he starts with an idea and just goes for it.
All right. Yeah.
But there's other writers who need the beginning, middle, and end.
I'm a bit of a control freak. I find the plotting difficult.
Yeah.
So I need to have sort of quite a tight structure to sort of hang everything on.
John Tomlinson's a bit like that.
Oh, okay.
When I write a comic strip, I'm more into the dialogue and it all flies out.
But
some people need panel by panel.
They
need it finished before they move on.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, there are different pros and cons to different ways of working, definitely.
Yeah.
So, I like having it's like a safety blanket of having the plot. Although, having said that, I think I'm writing it. I think I'll get a different idea. That'll change that a bit.
How about writing your own comics?
I wrote one, actually. It's a spoof sword and sandal epic called Majestus.
Oh, wow.
Actually, it might be called it. So that's the title, or that's the main character, or Blood and... What do I call it? Blood and Bronze, I call it. It's set in 300 BC, and it's ancient Greece and what have you. And it's a spoof on all the... like sword and sandal movies in the 60s. So I wrote that as something, you know what, if you get a chance, I want to draw this.
Yeah.
So, that's out there as well. Oh, so I may be just doing some character sketches and that if and when I get
that. That sounds good fun.
It would be like inspiration for that is, the Brendan Fraser mummy movies.
Yeah.
Pure popcorn. That's what I was all shooting for. You know?
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. So I've just heard there's going to be a bit of trouble in space when you're on the rocket ship and you're going to hit a time warp that's going to send you anywhere in the universe, imaginary or real, that you want to go to. Where would that be?
Well, I think it would be London, but it'd be London of the future, and not the future that we seem to be heading for of floods and viruses and Brexites and food shortages and loo roll shortages. It'd be the bright, shiny future imagined by Gerry Anderson.
Oh, excellent. Any specific show?
Thunderbirds, I think. Bridge collapses, you can fix it. Whereas,
a lot of disasters, though.
A lot of disasters, but nothing that can't be handled by, Thunderbirds.
That's true. And you get to hang out with Lady Penelope.
Well, that's always a good thing, isn't it?
Cool. Well, enjoy your future.
I'm sure I will. Me and Penny will be having a great time, I think.
I'll drive you around.
Yes, lady.
You've been listening to The Last Geek in Space. Thanks to Kev Hopgood for his time and Paul Morris in Vegetables at Last for the music. Last Geek in Space is a Bullpen Productions creation. Check out our websites at bullpenproductions.co.uk and alancouncil.com for more information. And while you're there, buy some of my books.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Alan! Alan! Alan!